From the studios of 2RPH in Sydney, this is 30 Laps with Dick. I'm Richard Lyon. Welcome. Geez, he must have been quick, that bloke.
Who?
Why, Jean-Pierre Wimmerly. So quick. He was Fangio's hero. Tell me more about it.
Well, we will this week in 30 Laps.
Hey, let's have a look at Pablo Escobar's Porsche as it goes up for sale. Japanese car makers are in for a shock. We better check that out. Shocks too about Tesla and their self-driving claims. Infamous cars, infamous claims, and a little-known genius. What a week this week. 30 laps. So we'll get started, shall we? With Tesla. Tesla gets caught out over bold self-driving claims. And that's from drive.com.au. It's an editorial and it's unattributed. The American electric car maker has talked up the performance and capability of its full self-driving mode. But documents sent by Tesla to the California Department of Motor Vehicles, or DMV for short, provide a conflicting opinion. In the documents from Tesla's Associate General Counsel, Eric Williams, to the DMV, the head of autonomous vehicles, he writes that the full self-driving mode is not, in fact, autonomous. Currently, neither autopilot nor FSD capability is an autonomous system, and currently no compromising feature, whether singularly or collectively, is autonomous or makes our vehicles autonomous, says Williams. Tesla charges $11,400 for four self-driving mode in New Zealand and Australia, which includes features such as auto parking, auto lane changing, navigate freeways, and including the ability to overtake slower cars that summon mode which allows the vehicle to get out of tight spots. But as the company admits to the regulators in its home state of California, it appears to be a long way off being fully driverless. Williams goes on to say that the features are level 2 autonomous. Autonomous technology is rated in levels 1 through 5. Level 1 features many common driver aids, such as radar cruise control that maintains distance with the car in front at variable speeds. The highest level 5 requires a no human interaction and the car will have no steering wheel or accelerator or brake pedals. Level 2 autonomous vehicles will keep you in the lane, brake and accelerate with traffic and recognise traffic light signals, but a human must always be in control of the vehicle. Tesla does not make it clear that drivers must stay in control of the vehicles when its tech is being used. The company sells its expensive feature on its potential future capabilities, which are constantly updated via the Air software updates. They cost less if buyers pay for them up front before they are functional, Tesla says. The features are available, subject to government approvals. Tesla boss Elon Musk has been outspoken on the controversial tech and its ability. In December, he claimed the brand would not fully roll out self-driving capabilities in 2021. I'm extremely confident of achieving full autonomy and releasing it to the Tesla customer base next year, he said. Tesla's other self-driving feature, dubbed Autopilot, has recently come under fire too. In 2020, a German court ruled Tesla Autopilot name misleading. The ruling could face and force the car maker to market its features differently in the future. Thanks to drive.com.au. And having read that little snippet, this one dovetails into it very nicely. Unfortunately, it's an accident. So it was based, two people die in Tesla car crash in Texas, and it was in The Guardian on the 20th of April this year. Again, it's a information piece. It's originally from Reuters, so it is unattributed. A car ran off the road and hit a tree north of Houston before bursting into flames, local media says. We better look at this, hey? Two men died after a Tesla vehicle, which had been believed to be operating without anyone in the driver's seat, crashed into a tree north of Houston, authorities said. There was no one in the driver's seat. Sergeant Cynthia Umazor of the Harris County Constable Precinct 4 said of the crash on Saturday night. The 2019 Tesla Model S was travelling at high speed when it failed to negotiate a curve and went off the road, crashing into a tree and bursting into flames, the local television studio KHOU-TV said. After the fire was extinguished, authorities located two passengers, with one in the front passenger seat and the other in the back seat of the Tesla, the report said. Citing Harris County Precinct 4 Police Officer Mark Herman. Tesla and the National Highway Traffic Authority Administration did not immediately respond to a request for comment. The accident came amid growing scrutiny over Tesla's semi-automated driving system, following recent accidents, as it is preparing to launch its updated full self-driving software to more customers. The US Auto Safety Agency said in March it has opened 27 investigations into crashed Tesla vehicles. At least three of the crashes occurred recently. Elon Musk, the Tesla CEO, said in January that he expects huge profits from the full self-driving software, saying he's highly confident the vehicle will be able to drive itself with reliability in excess of humans this year. The self-driving technology must overcome safety and regulatory hurdles to achieve the commercial success. The police sergeant said the two crash victims were born in 1961 and 1952. However, I fail to see what that's got to do with the story. But anyway, that is a terrible tale about self-driving, folks. I think we've still got a bit of a distance to travel. Pardon the pun. It's all a bit of a stranger in a strange world, I think. That was called Stranger in a Strange Land. Not world, but it was close enough, you got to agree. Let's move on. Here's a different story from drive.co.nz. Pablo Escobar's old Porsche 911 hits the market at $3 million. Crikey. Written by Andrew Slice on the 10th of March. Pablo Escobar might have been the most notorious drug lord the world has ever seen, but like a lot of high-flying rich listers, he also had a penchant for racing expensive cars, and he was quite good at it. Arguably, the coolest car that was ever piloted by the kingpin was his 1974 Porsche 911 RSR, which wore a 935 body kit throughout its ownership. Or his ownership, I should say, but has now been brought back to factory spec. Built for Formula One star Emerson Fittipaldi, the car first raced in 1974, International Race of Champions, all-star competition where it appeared in a total of 15 races throughout the series. Roger Penske, he's an old mate of 30 laps, isn't he? Roger Penske bought the RSR, who held on to it for a few years before the car made its way down to Colombia and was acquired by Escobar. It's unknown as to how many races Escobar entered in the 911, but considering that it shows just over 300 kilometres on the clock, we can't imagine he added many miles in his ownership. Upon returning to the United States, the car had lost its original livery and it had it restored, and the bodywork was reverted to the standard RSR kit. It's now up for sale via DuPont Registry, where the seller is asking a whopping $3 million US. Given the car's immaculate condition and all-star ownership, we wouldn't be surprised to see it fetch the million-dollar mark, but $3 million might be pushing it a bit. Stranger in a strange land, indeed. Thanks to Drive.co and Andrew Slice for that story. Now we go back into the corridors of time. To Motorsport Magazine, December 1999. Jean-Pierre Winmalee, Fangio's hero. Fiercely patriotic and destined to be killed before the world truly appreciated his abilities. Jean-Pierre Winmalee was a talent. Even Fangio looked up to him. William Mearns recalls the great man. His father was a journalist, and his son would be, in time, a poet. The motor racing fan can only rue the fact that Jean-Pierre Winmalee was not allowed the time also to wield the pen. An autobiography would have only just shed light on one of the finest racing drivers who ever lived, but on a man whose interests and escapades were by no means confined simply to motorsport. Winmalee was born in Paris, 26th of February 1908. His father, Auguste, was motoring correspondent for La Petite Parisienne. A racing luminaries were no stranger to the Winmalee household. Jean-Pierre grew up with a love of cars. "I adore the song of the engine," as he put it. But no real interest in racing. His dreams were full of sailing the world in the Merchant Navy. National service put paid to such childhood aspirations. He was sent to Morocco at the tail end of the Rif War and selected to be a staff driver. For 14 months, he said, "I was at liberty to practice on the desert tracks, driving flat out while I raced the powerful cars of the Sultan's fleet." Family friend W.F. Brady noted that the previously wayward youngster returned from Africa, quiet, calm, reserved, and with a lot of hidden fire. That fire raged strongest when he was at the wheel of a car, and he immediately immersed himself into organised racing. His first ever race, the 1930 French Grand Prix at Pau, although he was forced to retire on the second lap after the supercharger blew on his Bugatti Type 37A. His audacity at making the debut at what was then considered the most prestigious ever on the racing calendar was astonishing. He next entered the Monte Carlo Rally with friend Marcel Lasserique in a second-hand Lorraine Dietrich, setting out from icy Stavanger, as he did not come other serious, did most other serious competitors. The duo completed the test of reliability and consistency, only to find that the decider would be an obstacle course on the seafront. They were narrowly beaten to second place by one Donald Healy, and the previously unknown 21-year-old had made his mark, an opportunity in it his journalist father could not fail to seize upon. The remainder of 1931 was spent contesting the European Grand Prix circuit. Each race of 10 hours duration, sharing a Type 51 Bugatti with fellow Parisian Jean Goupillet. For 1932, Goupillet retained the Type 51, while Winmalee acquired one of the new Type 54 S's. He achieved FTD with it at the Tourbay Hill Climb at the end of March before it failed him the following month in Tunisia. It was returned to Molsheim, and he borrowed another Type 51, almost certainly from Lady Racer Madame Marus, for the Oran Grand Prix in Algeria. It would be his first GP victory. In the Oran GP, his desire to race and win in a French car, he appreciated the limitations of the superannuated Bugatti design and looked for the first, but by no means last, time towards Italy. In his new Alfa Romeo at BC 23,000 Monza, he won his first time out. Despite his initial success, though, 1932 showed his driving to be fine, but fast and erratic. A series of lurid accidents prompted him to curb his excesses and refine his driving style, taking the great Achille Verazzi as his role model. Although 1933 brought no wins, he emerged maturity and he began to impress different works teams. He was contracted by Bugatti for the 1934 season. This was, of course, his first season in the 750-kilogram formula, and the established teams were swept aside by the Mercedes and auto unions from Nazi Germany. Bugatti's star drivers fled to other marques in pursuit of success, leaving Le Patron to rely on the veteran Robert Benoist and his acolyte Wim Malee. The golden days may have been over for Bugatti, but the combined efforts of designer Jean Bugatti, driver Jean-Pierre Wim Malee, and his mechanic Robert Automotre, all of a similar age and great friends as well, dedicated the team to win. They succeeded in spinning out the magic just a little longer than they had any right to expect. From the parts still extant at Molsheim, Jean Bugatti created some astonishing specials. These he would drape with one of his ergonomical and stylish body shells, creating stunning cars. They were then handed to Wim Malee in the expectation he would win the races. Wins came in the 1936 ACF Grand Prix, and they came partnered by Sommer and twice at Le Mans, with Benoist in 1937 and Veyron in 1939, in cars loosely related to the Type 57 road car. And the single-seat Type 59-50B won at Montauthier and came a respectable second in the hill climbs at La Turbie and Prescott. But all this would soon turn on its head. August 1939, Jean Bugatti died. The next month, the world plunged into war. Wim Malee, an experienced pilot who had flown east to East London to take part in the 1936 South African Grand Prix, immediately signed up for the Armée de l'Air, but early French capitulation meant he did not see any action. Returning to the Civy Boulevard in Paris, it was under the occupation that he married the French ski champion Christiane de la Fressange. Confined to Paris, deprived of even a driving permit, he found some freedom to begin work on plans for a revolutionary road-going saloon car. Among many innovations was a rear engine, all-round independent suspension, and three seats abreast, with the driver located centrally. In a mere 50 years before the McLaren F1. Simultaneously, he was being touted as a potential minister for sport and planned an abortive Bugatti assault on Indianapolis with Raymond Saumur. Bugatti teammate Williams had formed an SOE network in Paris. After his capture by the Gestapo, a new group, Clergymen, rose from the ashes, headed by Robert Benoist. At Benoist's request, Wim Malee and his wife were recruited by Bugatti secretary Stella Tassadre, and in the months leading up to the Normandy landings, the group collected weapons and ammunition dropped by the RAF. So, to arm the volunteers of the forces of the Français de l'Intérieur. Hours after D-Day, Benoist was captured in Paris and the remainder of the group were ambushed at the farmhouse meeting spot. At the first sign that something was amiss, Wim Malee grabbed Shriek, his wife, and made to dive through the ground floor window. He fled under gunfire, while the petrified Shriek remained rooted to the spot. The entire group, save Jean-Pierre, who was by now hiding in a stream, were rounded up. Several, Benoist included, would die at the hands of the Nazis. Wimmerly linked up with a column of Americans making their way to Paris. Schrieck, meanwhile, was imprisoned at Fresnes before being put on a train for Germany, and a fate at best uncertain. Just out of Paris, she escaped and ultimately made her way to a house of friends where she and her husband were united. Told you it was a good story, didn't I? When Mélie was back in the Armée d'Air when the war ended, and was only granted permission for leave at the last minute so he could take part in the first post-war Grand Prix. This was in Paris's Bois de Boulogne on the 9th of September 1945. His late arrival meant his starting from the back of the grid, but the 4.7-litre Bugatti was easily the most powerful car in the field, and he won convincingly. The only works team to intimate a return to racing in 1946 was Alfa Corsa, and Wimmerly was keen to capitalise on his brief pre-war flirtation with Portello. He would be the only foreign driver in a team of Italians. At St. Cloud, he flared to finish, owing to a asymmetrical mechanical problem. Next, at Geneva, Wimmerly was unceremoniously punted off the track by, of all people, Tarzio Nuvolari, while leading, and he still managed to trail home in third. He raced through 46 and 47 with reasonable success, winning quite a few races on the European circuit. Wimmerly returned to Argentina the following year, with every confidence that he could repeat his win at Rosario. Before that came the Palermo Grand Prix in Buenos Aires. Practice started at 5:30 in the morning on the 28th of January 1949. Wimmerly drove some laps before stopping at the pits and for the first time in his life donned a crash helmet. The sight of the unruly crowds encroaching onto the track had disquieted him. He did not complete the first lap. Approaching the Curva de l'Autobomb, the Cordini, which was the vehicle he was driving, the Cordini spun and touched a straw bale. It launched into the air and smashed against a tree before falling to the ground. When Mélie, unconscious, was rushed to the nearby hospital Fernandez. Such were his injuries, a cracked skull and crushed chest, that he succumbed within minutes of admission. Many possible causes of the accident have been suggested. The two most plausible are that he was momentarily blinded by the rising sun, or, is the tenant held by his widow, that he was forced to take a wider line into the corner to avoid spectators who had spilled onto the track and had skidded on the dusty surface. In the months before his untimely death, Wimmerly's thoughts had been turning towards retirement. What is certain is that he would not have been quiet. His road car was on the verge of entering mass production, and he had discussed with Ralph the formation of an air freight company, and there were still rumours persisting of an entrance into politics. At his funeral, Jean-Pierre Wimmerly was posthumously awarded Legion d'Honneur. The citation concludes, "His numerous victories and international reputation have immeasurably increased the prestige of France. He would have wished for no other epitaph." Wow, eh? Well, that was from Motorsport Magazine, originally December 1999. And it was written by William Mearns. He walked a bit of a tightrope in those races, didn't he?
I'm up on a tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire. It's a circus game with you and me. I'm up on a tight rope.
Yes, one side ice and one side's fire. You're not going to believe this. We've run out of time to talk about a couple of the other things we're going to do. So we'll have to leave that for another day. So let's go back to our old feared favourite from Autocar magazine, weird and surprising car facts for our strange days. Here's a beauty. I bet you wondered about this and you lay awake at night wondering how it all started. The 1996 Jensen Interceptor holds the honour of being the first car ever to be fitted with a courtesy delay for its interior light, so it stayed on after the door was closed to aid entry to the driver's home. The 2001 Lexus SC430 was the first car to feature an illuminated sill plate with the word Lexus lighting up at night when the door was opened. How about that? We've got time for one more. Back in 2009, Top Gear's Hammond, Clarkson and May were set a yet another challenge. This time they were to invent a new electric car. And as the dynamic trio went into the workshop to conjure up their finest ideas, the Hammerhead Eagle Eye Thrust was born. Part shed, part car, the Eye Thrust was presented to the televisual public. Its appearance on Top Gear concluding with the perhaps toughest test of all, a full road test by the world's oldest car magazine. Yes, Autocar. And their verdict? It's impossible to regard the Eye Thrust as a success. There we leave Autocar's weird and wonderful car facts for another time. I know you enjoy them as much as I do. That about rounds us out, I think. Thank you, as always, for your company. I hope I've amused you or informed you over the last 28 minutes or so. We'll talk about something completely different next week. Probably not an old, long-dead motor racing driver from France or Argentina, for that matter. But I'm sure we'll have something of interest for you. And it appears that we don't buy a Tesla without reading all the fine print. But it's a new age dawning in motor vehicles, and the electric car is here to stay. Until next week, when we talk all things motoring during our 30 laps, this is Richard Lyon saying bye for now.